always barge in again with another Boat Talk Cruise on Saturday, June 22nd. It's a 2.5-hour maritime expedition up and down Somes Sound, America's former fjord. Enjoy a potluck gastronomic glide along the coast of Mount Desert Island by boatyards, monolithic granite hard spots, watering holes, and various wildlife great for photographing. Cruise will take place aboard the classic vessel Sea Princess, kindly provided by Sea Princess Cruises. You can find out about them at cruiseacadia.com. Everybody brings some finger food and galleons of drink that we put on the engine box to share and devour during the voyage. Rusty anchor Mike Joyce sits in the back of the boat and converses with anyone, while Alan Sprague stands in the front of the boat offering narration of the local sights. The Sea Princess will leave the Northeast Harbor Town Dock on June 22nd at 6:15 p.m. and return around 8:30. The vessel is fully covered, and we go whatever the weather. Tickets are $20 each, with children under 12 free. Ticket sales go to support WERU. Purchase yours, just call WERU during regular business hours at 207-469-6600. The cruise usually sells out, so don't wait long. Information is available at weru.org. And thanks again to cruiseacadia.com.
Support for WERU comes from our listeners and from Mabel Wadsworth Center, providing comprehensive sexual and reproductive health services to people in northern and eastern Maine since 1984. Insurance, Maine Care, self-pay accepted, and reduced fees for uninsured clients. MabelWadsworth.org.
You're listening to WERU FM 89.9 in Blue Hill 99 and WERU.org. We are listener-supported, volunteer-powered, and a voice of many voices. Stay tuned for All About Aging with your host, Peg Cruikshank.
Today is Elizabeth Johns from Orono. And before we turn to Elizabeth and her knowledge of aging policy issues, particularly Social Security, I want to tell our audience a few things about my background and then a few things about the format of this program. We will be on the air every third Wednesday at this time, 10 a.m., and the program will be archived. I studied aging at San Francisco State 20 years ago, got a master's there, and when I moved to Maine, I was able to teach courses on aging at USM and at University of Maine in Orono. I edited a book on aging and literature, and I wrote a book on aging. On a later program, I'll give more detail about that. I've recently been to a couple of conferences on aging, one in Canada and one in Bar Harbor. And in the next program, I'll tell a few things about what I learned there, what issues came up at those conferences. One was more focused on the humanities, and the one in Bar Harbor more on geriatric issues. Lots is going on in Maine now. There are current issues, particularly death with dignity passed in the legislature in Maine and was signed into law by Janet Mills, our governor. On a later program, I'd like to have the sponsor of that legislation on the program and have some that's controversial slightly, and we'll find out how the strategy used to pass that death with dignity. I think we're more states don't have it than do have it, so Maine is ahead there. Now, as far as this program, All About Aging monthly program, it will have the main part of the program will be interviews, because there are a number of people in Maine who know about aging and who work in the field of aging. It's such a broad field that that means the subjects of this program will be broad as well. I hope to have some information about current news articles on aging from various media, the Washington Post, for example, and the New York Times, and other media. There's some interesting aging issues. There are always interesting aging issues, particularly now, I think, because of the population aging. The conference I attended in Canada had a big sign saying, "Population aging is nothing to be afraid of." So we can decide later on in this program why people think it might be and why the people who study aging think it's really a challenge but not a disaster. Also on this program, occasionally I will offer some ideas and speculation about aging as an experience, as a phenomenon, both from the past, what people used to think about aging, and the current ideas that are being debated at conferences and in the media. Finally, on this program, I hope to talk briefly about some new books on aging. There are quite a few new books, and I will evaluate them and encourage you to get your local library, perhaps, to order the best books on aging. Now, turning to our guest, Elizabeth Johns. Welcome, Elizabeth, to the program. I know you know a lot about these aging policy areas. I'm more in the humanities and aging, so much of what you'll have to offer us this morning will be either new to me or something that I have a vague sense of, but you offer a much clearer sense of the issues.
Well, I certainly hope I can do that, Peg, and thank you so much for inviting me today.
You're welcome. Now, an introduction of Elizabeth. She's a faculty associate at the Center on Aging at the University of Maine. As a researcher, she's focused on the economic well-being of older persons. In 2017, she was a member of a team that won a national award from AARP for policy proposals regarding Social Security's future solvency and its ability to provide for Americans' income security in retirement. That's probably one of the most important aging issues, isn't it? Enough money for retirement. Elizabeth completed a PhD in gerontology from the University of Massachusetts, Boston in 2016 when she was 72 years old. Her dissertation research focused on the impact of extended periods of caregiving on the financial resources women and men accumulate before they retire. Now, let's start at the beginning. Elizabeth, what made you decide to become a gerontologist?
Well, thanks again, Peg. It's a real pleasure to be here with you today. Congratulations on the new show, and also congratulations to WERU for giving attention to aging, which is such an important issue for us all. At every stage of life. Starting at the beginning, I got interested in aging and gerontology through personal experience, through personal stories, and I think that's how many of us start investigating a particular topic.
Yes.
In my case, it was the early 1990s. I was living in Maine with my family, husband teaching at the university, two sons in high school, and my dad, who was a widow, was living in Florida by himself, and I'm an only child, and he started needing help. He couldn't really live at home independently any longer, and he certainly didn't want to go into a nursing home. And so it fell to me to start arranging care for him. And that started a period of about 3 years of me going back and forth from Maine to Florida, Florida to Maine. I was often there for weeks at a time trying to figure out how to provide the care that he needed and let him stay in his own home. We ended up hiring a team of nurses' aides who were just wonderful people. They were there with him 24 hours a day in his home. They provided quality of life for him. They let him stay at home. They did wonderful work, and I am enormously appreciative and grateful to them to this day. At the same time, things on the home front were a little rocky because I wasn't there when my kids were finishing up in high school. My husband was trying to maintain a demanding job and take care of the household at the same time. And I was, you know, as I say, gone for weeks at a time. And all of that, and then there was the enormous cost of bringing in. My dad was paying for the care provided by the nurses' aides. He was paying for that out of pocket. This is not something that Medicare covers at all. He didn't have private insurance that would cover that. I was paying his bills. I was paying attention to his financing, and I was watching huge sums of money going out. Just, you know, and fortunately, it was a period when the stock market, he had money in the stock market, you know, and he was very fortunate in that respect. The stock market was booming at that time, so we would send out enormous sums of money, and somehow the account would sort of fill back up again. It was very unusual. And things like that don't happen very often, but, for, you know, the timing was...
Timing was good.
In that respect, the timing was pretty good. At the same time, these nurses' aides who were doing this wonderful work on behalf of my dad, they were getting paid $9 an hour. And I, at the time, I knew that wasn't enough. They were not really getting paid what they deserved. They were doing excellent work, skilled work, caring work. And they made such an enormous difference in my dad's life and certainly in my life because I was able to come home and leave him with them for weeks at a time. So all of that, when all of that was over with, I came home with a lot of questions about how people finance their retirements in this country. Not everybody does it the way my dad did because he was in the working for a company for 30 some odd years. He had health insurance when he retired. He had a defined benefit pension. We'll talk about those in a minute.
Yeah.
Those are pretty scarce now.
Unfortunately.
He had savings. Yeah, he was very fortunate in many ways. Got me thinking about how we do finance retirement in this country. It got me thinking about caregiving and who provides it and what is it like for what kinds of an impact does that have on their lives? How are these nurses' aides making do with $9 an hour? And what kind of an impact was it having on me, having to go back and forth?
Yeah.
Essentially,
yeah.
What I ended up doing was stopping the career work I had been doing to that point and shifting gears and just spending an awful lot of time on Dad. So those things raised a lot of big questions for me that I wanted to study a bit more.
And a so career I went back sacrifice, to wasn't it?
Essentially it was, yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I never did get back to the work that I had been doing mm-hmm. Up until that point.
Mm-hmm.
A three-year interruption was damaging in that
of
respect.
Of course. And the job market in Maine at that time there weren't a lot of options.
Well, I was working in academic publishing.
Yes.
There are not a lot of jobs
no.
in Maine in
Maine
academic publishing.
Yeah.
So it was time to shift gears.
Right.
And going and studying gerontology seemed like a good way to do that. Get some serious answers to those questions that I'd had discovered through personal experience and personal travail.
Yeah, travail. And then you took my class.
I did. Yeah, I started at University of Maine. You had just arrived.
Yes, I was fresh from California.
Yeah, yeah. And one of the first courses in aging I took was your Women in Aging course.
Yes.
And that and some of the other coursework kind of alerted me and started me thinking much more intensively about caregiving. And again, who does the caregiving and what kind of an impact does that have on their lives? Typically, caregiving is done by women. Not always, but predominantly it's women who do the work. It's something that we may be called upon to do multiple times in our lives. So women are typically the ones who raise the children. They may get to the age of 40 or 45, 50, and their parents start needing extra help. They may have a husband, a spouse, whose health is compromised, and they have to start spending time, more time with them. Lots in Maine, we know lots and lots of women are becoming carers of their grandchildren.
Yes.
For one reason or another, when their parents aren't able to
to
do that kind of work. So caregiving has major impacts on the people who do the care, the informal care I'm talking about now, the people who aren't paid to do that kind of care.
Right.
And it can impact their financial well-being when they get to retirement.
I think that's not so well known or understood, is it? We understand it when we get there and see how our caregiving may have lowered our incomes. But it's not something you think about at age 55 when your elderly parents need a lot of help.
Right. Yeah. I think there's certainly not enough attention to that in the policy arena. And to the extent that people who talk about retirement security say anything about it, they sort of advise you not to do that. But you know, many of us don't have that.
Right.
Don't have that.
Especially
choice.
Only children.
So you think about where does the money come from that we're supposed to retire on? It comes from being in the workplace and getting a wage. We earn the wage. Hopefully our employer puts some money aside with us for a pension. And, of course, there's Social Security, which we'll talk about a little bit more.
Yes.
To the extent that women are not in the workforce, they're losing out on that because even though they're providing essential work, it's absolutely work society cannot do without. You know, we cannot have a healthy functioning society without people doing that kind of caregiving work.
That's right.
And at the same time, they're penalized for it financially.
A paradox.
Yeah.
So let's talk about that project you were involved with. The AARP project on Social Security, the impact of caregiving. Mm-hmm. How did you come to focus on the economic issues? I think we partially answered that mm-hmm. question by your experience mm-hmm. with your father.
Right. Well, one of the first things I started noticing were the differences, the disparities between men's experiences and women's experiences, and how those impact retirement income security. One of the big differences is how much time women spend in the workforce as opposed to how much time men do.
Yeah.
And we're well past the time, you know, the 60s and 70s when women started going back into the workforce in large numbers. But then we hit kind of a plateau. And if you compare women and men, men, when they're in their prime working years, say 25 to 55, 60, somewhere in there, only about maybe 10%, depending on the age, but only about 10% of men are not in the workforce for one reason or another during that
age group, yeah.
Meanwhile, same age groups for women, there's somewhere between 25 and 30% of women who are not in the workforce.
That's a big gap, isn't it?
It's a huge gap. And that's, you know, we're how many years now past second wave feminism when supposedly women were back in the workforce.
There's more to the story, obviously.
Well, you think about what are these women doing?
Right.
And they're home taking care of somebody. The ones who are not home taking care of somebody, maybe they're working part-time because they're also taking care of somebody.
Or paying a lot of their salary for childcare.
Uh-huh. Yep. Well, that's a whole nother...
That's another story.
Yeah. That certainly impacts the amount of money that we're able to set aside and save for retirement. So, you know, down at the other end, when you finally do get to retirement age, we can look at statistics that show that women are penalized. More women than men live in poverty. Statistics are, you know, about 9 or 10% of all people living in poverty in the U.S., similar statistics in Maine. Women, as I say, much more likely to be living in poverty than men. And then, if you look at minority populations,
yes,
Hispanics, Latin, African Americans, Asians, their rate of poverty when they reach retirement is higher than for whites. And those reflect not just caregiving, but also other disparities, economic inequality that affects those populations.
That's
as
right.
Well.
Structural inequality. Yeah. Also, I've read that women of color begin their caregiving responsibilities earlier because the health of their parents, it's a big generalization, mm-hmm. but their parents may need care sooner than the parents of white people who may have had a more solid foundation for wage earning to start with.
Yeah. So even if you're looking at numbers of, let's say, African Americans living in poverty,
yes,
the general figure could be sort of like 18%, something like that. But if you look at women, higher numbers of African American women are living in poverty than African American men. And the same is true for Native Americans, for Asians, for all ethnic groups. So I think you know, we really do need to spend more time focusing on the impact and the penalty that people are paying for doing this caregiving.
Yeah, penalty is a good word, isn't it?
It's not one we typically associate with caregiving, but there really is one there.
No, certainly. I mean, statistically, I don't remember the number of the monetary value in the United States of the caregiving provided free by families and women. It's a staggering sum of money, isn't it?
Yeah, I think AARP has tried to figure that out, and I don't remember what the numbers are either,
right.
But they're very large. So would you like me to say something about how people do prepare for retirement now?
Yes, yes.
Okay.
Let's switch to that.
Okay. Gerontologists are always talking about the three-legged stool.
Yes, I remember
of
that.
Income, security, and retirement.
Uh-huh.
And I think it's probably become a fairly general term as well. But basically, you know, somebody figured out that, you know, what we need is three different forms of
yes.
support for setting aside money and being ready to retire. And it divides the responsibility neatly between the individual worker, the employer, and the society as a whole.
Yeah.
So the individual worker is supposed to be setting aside savings. Mm-hmm. The employer is helping provide pension savings as well, setting aside money that the worker can draw on later. And we're also putting money into Social Security. Social Security will be there when we retire. However, the system for some years now has been weakening.
Yes. Yes.
We know that people have more trouble saving now than they used to.
Yeah.
Part of that is traceable to the fact that wages have been flat for decades.
Yeah.
They haven't kept pace with the cost of living. People are faced with high costs of housing. Their earnings are not going up. They're paying for childcare. Childcare is extremely expensive. People are going into debt, or they're coming out of school with debt.
Yes.
I've heard of people who are in their 40s and 50s going into debt to help their children get into college.
And seems to me that Elizabeth Warren, when she was studying bankruptcy, found that the most common cause was health care debt that people couldn't pay the expenses for their health care.
Mm-hmm.
So that set her on a path mm-hmm. of exploring these economic issues.
Right. Yeah, so you can be saving money and then have something happen to your health and, right. you know, there goes your retirement plan. And then there's the employer's role. And I mentioned defined benefit pensions.
Yes.
My dad had one of those.
Yes.
Uh-huh. Basically, the employer guarantees that you, when you retire, you're going to get a certain amount of money to live on from your pension.
Right.
Those kinds of plans have pretty much gone away. Starting, I think, in the 1970s or 80s, employers started shifting the responsibility for making sure that those investments could be would pay off and they could meet their obligation to the worker. They started shifting those responsibilities onto the worker, him or herself.
Yeah.
So now we have much more prevalent form of quote unquote pension is the 401k, where the employer will perhaps contribute money to it, but it's up to you to decide how you're going to invest that money, and there's no guarantee of how much you're going to have when you reach retirement.
So instead of having a pool of resources that could be managed, it's the individual's duty now to figure out
that's right
how to yeah. handle this money.
Yeah. It's kind of the you're on your own
yes.
system.
Fitting in with the individualism, I suppose, of the prevalent political philosophy we've had maybe since Reagan,
mm-hmm.
that whatever the government does, you, the individual, can do better.
That's certainly been one of the strong rationales. There's a lot of research showing that, in fact, individuals are not doing better.
No, and we were somewhat, as individuals, I think, somewhat spared by the defined benefit because we didn't have to stay up late at night figuring out what to do with these pools of money.
Mm-hmm.
It was taken care of.
It was taken care of.
Mostly successfully.
Mostly successfully. Yeah, hopefully. I should mention that at no point was more than about half of the population covered by
Yes.
these kinds of pensions. And I think that's still true today. A lot of people are working for jobs where, you know, the employer just doesn't offer that kind of benefit. So that's another reason why the three-legged stool is not as sturdy as we would like it to be.
No.
And then
one of the issues when Uber drivers protested that they were not getting any help for retirement from their labors for Uber, but that's true of the gig economy generally, I suppose.
Yeah. I think looking out into the future, I'm kind of worried that the gig economy is kind of the wave of the future.
It could be. There's certainly signs that could be, which is ominous as far as salting away enough mm-hmm. money for our retirements.
Yeah. Yeah, but it allows the employer to offload some extra costs.
Yes.
That I suppose their argument is that it makes them more competitive in a
right.
very competitive marketplace.
Right.
But it does so on the backs of
yes.
workers who are not really in a good position to compensate for that. You know, they don't
yeah.
have anywhere else to go.
Exploiting the worker always is an economic benefit to the bosses, I suppose, figuring out how they can do less. And they would argue because of the Great Recession and the slow recovery, they can't afford to be more generous in the area of worker security.
They certainly do make that argument, yeah. So basically, that leaves Social Security. That's the third leg of the retirement, the traditional third leg. Some people try to continue working past the conventional retirement age, that works for some people, and it doesn't work for everybody. You know, people's health can sometimes surprise them, and
that's right.
Their careers end sooner than they had expected.
If you've had a physically demanding job, and you're 65, the option of working a few more years simply isn't there for you.
It's
you
not
cannot
that,
physically
yeah.
do that work.
Right. Without further damaging your health, possibly. Yeah.
When mandatory retirement was lifted for professors, I remember there was great concern that these tottery old professors would stay on and on and on. As it happens, they were all too eager to quit working when they were 65. So that myth was taken care of. Although scientists in labs, apparently, are the more likely to stay on through their late life than people in community colleges. So there was a class difference there, too, as far as extending your working life.
Well, I think people who are physically able to do that kind of work and have the kind of work that is continuous for the kind of work they've done in the past, they're often in a good position to do that, and a lot of people are doing that now. Those people we're now seeing that larger numbers of folks are.
You've been listening to All About Aging on WERU. Today our guest is Elizabeth Johns, who's very knowledgeable about aging policy, public policy, and we're talking about caregiving and Social Security, some of the possibilities for improving Social Security, rescuing it from its perilous condition.
There is a lot to say on that subject, too. So maybe I could start with just a little background about how we acquired Social Security.
Good idea. How did we get Social Security?
Social Security is one of the jewels of the New Deal, the 1930s. I'd like to back up just a moment and with a little story about my husband's grandmother.
Yes.
Who became a widow in 1923. Her husband was in his 40s, and he died suddenly of a heart attack. He had been working for an insurance company. He actually had a life insurance policy. And for some reason, the insurance company did not pay the family anything in the way of a death benefit. Social Security did not exist in those days. She had five children. And she had, the youngest child was due to be born in 3 months when this happened. So four children and another one on the way.
On the way, yeah.
And here's this youngish woman in her 40s who has suddenly lost the breadwinner in the family. And from that point on, her life became so difficult. She had to kind of fall back on the goodwill of family members. I know they helped her out financially. Her church helped her out. Somehow she managed to keep the family together through all of that. And that's the kind of thing that Social Security, one of the kinds of things that Social Security has made go away. Those kinds of things, those stories don't happen anymore. Social Security was passed in 1935, in the midst of the Depression. I think that's one of the reasons that the Roosevelt administration was able to overcome conservative opposition to the program, which was pretty strong at the time. People were worried about communism even then. Social Security features a retirement benefit, which we're all pretty familiar with. There's also a disability benefit. So if you, the worker, suddenly become unable to work any longer, you have insurance and Social Security will give you a benefit. And in the event that the breadwinner dies, the family members, the children and the spouse, can also get a benefit from Social Security. One of the things that's unique about Social Security is that it is inflation protected. So my 401k, for example, is going to be a flat benefit for the entire time I'm in retirement. And I know that over time it will lose value because of inflation. Social Security adjusts itself for inflation every year so that the benefit continues to maintain its worth over the the period of the workers' retirement. So it's a really good deal.
And isn't that a dramatic change, too? The widow with five children was driven into poverty and dependent on charity to survive.
Yeah.
She was energetic and strong and did survive. But after Social Security, a woman in her situation, a widow with children, would not have been impoverished.
Mm-hmm.
That would be a strong argument for
And I think it's always a risk when you assume that charity is going to take care of a social need.
Right.
And
for
some people it may, and for other people it won't.
Yeah.
Capriciousness is not a good foundation for public policy.
Right. Right. Yes. Yeah. Well said. Mm-hmm. Capriciousness is not a good foundation for public policy.
So, maybe we could take a minute just to talk about how Social Security is funded right now. How does it work? How does it pay for itself?
How does the system work?
And why is everybody saying that there's a crisis in Social Security?
Right.
It's not that complicated a system. It's funded by three sources. There's the taxes that workers pay, the payroll tax on whatever your wages are. You pay 6.2% of your wages. Your employer pays 6.2 into the Social Security system. If you happen to be self-employed, then you pay the full shot. You pay whatever it is, 12.4%. So that's one stream. Social Security also gets interest income from the federal government. So the money that you and I have been paying into the Social Security system goes into a trust fund. The federal government borrows from this trust fund in order to fund its current activities. It promises to pay the money back to Social Security, and it promises to pay interest on whatever it is borrowed. So it gets a substantial income stream. I think it was $83 billion last year, $83 billion just in interest income from the federal government. So that's the second stream. And the third stream is that people who get a higher Social Security benefit also pay taxes on that benefit. So there's the money that's going into the system. Now, the last major overhaul of the Social Security system happened in 1983. And at that time, Social Security was about a year away from insolvency. In other words, it was not going to continue to be able to pay its obligations based on the money that was coming into the system. So that was about 40 years ago. And we are in a similar situation now, except we have current estimates are to about 2035. To solve this problem. That at some point, we are going to have less money in than we need to have money going out. And current estimate is that that's about 2035.
And after that, won't about 80% of what we're owed come to us?
Yeah. I should have mentioned that since 1983, Social Security has been deliberately collecting more money than is going out every month in retirement benefits. And it's been putting that money aside, knowing that the large baby boom cohort was going to be retiring and was going to be costing a lot more money than would be coming in from current workers. So there is now $2.9 trillion, a little plus or minus, in this trust fund to help pay for the baby booms and their retirement.
Is that a result of the 1983 adjustment?
Yeah. All right. Yeah, there are some very skillful actuaries working for the Social Security system, and they look out decades in advance anticipate. You can tell 50 years ahead of time who's going to be retiring because those people have been born already.
Yes.
So they knew that this large baby boom
bulge,
thank you, was going to go through this system. They prepared for it. That's why there is this big surplus in the system. And the surplus will be there for the next 15 years-ish to help pay. And then, supposedly, if we don't do anything about it between now and then, this surplus will be used up, and then we'll be just relying on current income to pay current expenses.
So it sounds to me, Elizabeth, as if there's less a crisis than a challenge that can be managed.
Absolutely. One of the things I find interesting is that in 1983, the system was within about a year of running out of funds. We've got 15 years.
15 years.
That's not an argument for postponing action.
No.
Because you can take small actions over a long period of time that don't have as big an impact on people's lives. It allows workers to plan ahead so they know what they can count on when they retire. Right now, you hear a lot of people saying, well, I don't really know if Social Security will be there when I retire.
That's foolish. That's a myth, isn't it?
Well, I think it is. Yeah. Politically, first of all, it's been an extremely successful program.
It's true.
It has kept millions of people out of poverty.
Right.
Right. I think I've seen a figure, something like half of people over 65 would be living in poverty now
without
Social Security.
Mm-hmm. I've seen some similar statistics. So it's a great success.
It's one of the best public policies the U.S. has ever devised. I think it's an excellent program. Its administrative costs are negligible, less than 1% of the money that comes into the system, or the money that goes out of the system.
Less than
1% is devoted to administrative costs, which makes it extremely competitive with the private sector.
Yes, very much so.
Because the private sector needs to draw off profits. Social Security does not do that.
What about the proposal to privatize Social Security?
that's going to come around again.
Right.
It comes up, you know, sort of like weeds.
Yes.
The last big push was during the administration of George W. Bush.
Right.
And you remember that there was a lot of talk about how people needed to have choices in how they funded their retirements.
Right.
And that maybe it would make sense if some of that money that was going into Social Security went instead into stocks, private investments.
Right.
You know, you could probably, you know, the argument was you could do better than this, you know, sort of boring.
But that was
but
true.
Guaranteed
only
benefit that you're going to get from Social
only
Security.
Only if the market was doing well.
Well, and there was a lot of talk and push to bring in these private investments into Social Security.
And the corporations had their eye on some of the Social Security.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
And then 2008 happened,
the
arrival of the Great Recession.
Right.
And banks failed, and Wall Street firms failed, the stock market crashed, and, you know, anyone who had been depending on that part of their portfolio for their retirement took a significant hit, and the talk about private accounts kind of went away for a while.
Yes, rightly so. The market giveth what the market taketh away.
Social Security doesn't come with those kinds of risks, and I think that's another reason why it's a important program. It's one that we need to be well aware of. We need to understand how it works, and we need to be prepared to defend it.
What about the proposal to raise the retirement age to 70 before you could get your full Social Security?
Well, I can't imagine that's going to be too popular either.
No.
One of the compromises that policymakers made back when they were crafting the 1983 amendments was to raise the retirement age to 67 gradually over a period of years.
And that's happened.
In the process of happening now.
Right.
Yeah.
Was a compromise.
People used to be able to take full retirement benefits at age 65. People can still start taking retirement at 62. They start getting benefits then, but they are reduced. Actuarially reduced.
Right. Well, isn't it the case that since the life expectancy of people of color is somewhat lower, depending on which group we're talking about, Japanese Americans do better than Filipinas. But if you raise the retirement age to 70, a lot of people of color aren't going to live that long.
It's possible.
So
yeah,
that would really exploit them by having all that money out of their paycheck that they don't get to.
We don't want them subsidizing the retirement of the...
Now, certain numbers of white people will not live to age 70 either.
And we were talking about how the decline in... about the decline in life expectancy that has just...
Right.
The last couple of years has become apparent in the U.S.
It's shocking because ever since 1900, the life expectancy has been going up, up, up. And now in several parts of the country, it's slipping. The Deep South, Appalachia, and Washington County, Maine, which is really shocking when you think about it because we're in the north. We tend to think of ourselves as economically better shape than the Deep South or Appalachia. So I suppose some of the reasons for that might be the drug epidemic, poverty, distance from adequate health care, perhaps, and maybe generations of people dependent on welfare to a slightly higher degree than in other parts of Maine. I'm just guessing about this, but I think that endemic poverty may be a bigger problem up there.
That would be, you know, something, it's not something I've looked at particularly, but there's certainly something really significant going on there.
Oh, absolutely, and really calling out for research. Why is the life expectancy, against all expectations, going down instead of increasing?
Yeah, and you compare what's happening in the U.S. with what's happening in some of the wealthy countries in Europe. And their life expectancy continues to rise. Why are we going in the other direction? There's something wrong with that.
There's something structurally amiss to have that happen.
Yeah.
How about the idea of lifting the cap on Social Security? That would be a way to ensure its solvency.
Okay. Let's talk about a couple of ideas for...
What could we do?
There's lots and lots of proposals for reforming Social Security. There is no end of them.
You've been listening to a public affairs program on WERU. This is All About Aging. I'm Peg Cruikshank, the host, and our guest today is Elizabeth Johns, who works in the area of aging policy. Now, fixing Social Security. I guess we'd be famous, Elizabeth, if we fixed Social Security.
Somebody's going to take some credit for coming up with a solution when it finally happens.
Right.
And I hope we don't get down to the wire the way they did in 1983 and leave it until the last hour.
System collapsing.
But right now, we've got... sort of opposing forces. We got Republicans pulling in one direction and Democrats pushing in the other direction. And we're just not making any progress. But as I was starting to say, there are plenty of ideas, lots and lots of ideas for how Social Security could be changed. And I think some of them are excellent ideas. You mentioned raising the cap.
Yes,
raising
which is
the cap.
What, $132,900,
I think is what it is this year.
So after that, a person making a big wage doesn't pay any more Social Security than the person making the 130, whatever it is.
Less
is
than 132.
Yeah. Not many people understand that, as far as I can tell.
So, if you're making under $132,000, your earnings are subject to the Social Security payroll tax,
right.
The 6.2% we talked about. Anything that you make over $132,900 is not subject to that tax. And one of the reasons why Social Security is running into some projected shortfalls right now is that more and more people are earning over that cap and not paying taxes on it.
Not paying taxes.
So there's money that's not going into the system.
Right, that could go in.
Yeah.
You don't have to be a socialist to say that's really unfair.
Well,
if someone's paycheck is $200,000, they should pay more tax than someone who's earning the $130,000, whatever it is.
Or, you know, $35,000 a year or whatever it is. You know, yeah. So it sort of goes against the progressive design of the Social Security system, the way it is intended to work.
And now that economic equality is increasing, it seems even less fair than it was when there was we were aware at least that the 1% wasn't so monstrously more prosperous than all the rest of us.
Right.
And they don't seem to have the philanthropic spirit either of George Soros or Bill Gates. I'd like to see more billionaires building bridges and fixing highways.
Well, I think this gets us back to charity again.
Yes, it's true.
It's not a good way to run society.
not a good way. It's a temporary fix, maybe.
Yeah.
By the way, did you notice how good the highway was over here from Ellsworth to Orland? Beautiful new highway.
I did notice that. Yeah, my car appreciated it. My springs.
Well, yeah. How about your future work, Elizabeth? We've talked a lot about the present and problems and solutions. What's next for you?
Oh, well, most immediately, my husband and I, we're now in our mid-70s. Mm-hmm. And it's time to think about where are you going to spend the rest of your life, you know? And we have a son living in Southern California with his family. And so we'd like to relocate closer to them. And so we're in the process of getting our household ready to pack up and move, which is taking an enormous amount of energy.
I'm sure.
I'm looking forward to being over soon.
Yes. Yes.
So I can get back to working on aging issues. And one of the things I'd like to do, we're planning to go to New Mexico, and one of the things I'd like to do when we get there is to start talking to folks who are receiving Social Security income and whose incomes are still put them in under the poverty threshold. And I'd like to highlight some of those stories because I think there's a tendency to assume that if you are not well off economically, it's probably your fault.
Yes.
There's kind of this default
right.
way of thinking.
It's to blame.
Yeah. I did well. I don't see any reason why you couldn't have done well.
Right.
And I think if we had more of those stories that show what the challenges were and how it was that people were able or who arrived at retirement without having sufficient resources,
right.
I think if we understood that better, there'd be more sympathy for guaranteeing people at least a minimum benefit in Social Security, which is one of the things that a colleague and I proposed actually to AARP, that people, retirees, should be guaranteed a minimum benefit that would keep them out of poverty. Right now, you can get a Social Security benefit and you can still live in poverty, and I think there's something wrong with that.
Yes, the idea of Social Security is to provide that safety net for us, and the safety net is there, but it's not all that safe because we're still poor.
Mm-hmm.
Well, you certainly be getting a warmer climate than you have in Maine.
We're looking, it's really hard to be thinking about leaving Maine this time of year.
This time of year, right.
The winter was quite long.
Yes, and you'll be closer to your son in L.A. without having to live in California and pay California housing prices.
Well, that's one of the things. We were looking ahead and saying, we're in our mid-70s now, and we need to start thinking about what will work for us as we move into our 80s and conceivably even older than that. My husband's mother is 100 years old, so
100 years old.
His chances are pretty good, I think.
He's got the good genes.
I think he does.
Yeah.
I'm counting on it.
Is she in pretty good shape for 100?
Considering, yes. So we're trying to anticipate what kinds of needs we're going to have and what kinds of, you know, driving in L.A. traffic didn't seem like a really good plan for us.
We're not prepared. We're not conditioned for that kind of traffic.
Yeah.
You know, I read that in Japan, people used to get a card when they were 100 years old. But now there's so many that they're not getting those cards anymore. That's not such a big deal.
Uh-huh. Well, I'm not sure we're quite at that stage yet. Yeah. But anyhow, so I've also started taking a new interest in housing. I had never spent a lot of time focusing on housing and kind of the services and options that are available for older adults in housing. And there are some really interesting things out there. We had a meeting with a group in Albuquerque that's putting together a multi-generational co-housing group.
Uh-huh.
And the idea is everybody sort of has their own little individual housing units, and then there's kind of this collective system as well. And that seemed very appealing, and the idea that it would be intergenerational, so, you know, you wouldn't be off, you know, just in, you know, 55 and older housing, although there's nothing particularly wrong with that either.
Someone to carry the groceries out of the trunk of your car.
Maybe.
Do we have that in Maine, intergenerational housing, with the idea of an alternative for elderly people who don't want to stay in their homes and they don't want to go into assisted living?
Well, I know there is a co-housing group in Belfast. Mm-hmm. I don't know what the age profile is there. We knew we weren't probably going to stay in Maine, so we never did investigate that.
But it'd be interesting when you're in New Mexico for a while to see if there are some big, dramatic differences between status of elderly people there and status of elderly here. For example, will you find Albuquerque is an age-friendly city?
we will find out.
You'll find out. Yeah. I know in Maine we're one of the leaders in the country for the numbers of cities that have become age-friendly cities.
Designate themselves as age-friendly and then start working towards implementing some of the changes that allow people to stay in the community for a longer period of time.
Well, Elizabeth, it's been a great pleasure to hear about your work and to hear something about your future and to know you won that prize for a policy proposal for AARP. And it would be great to think that some of those ideas would be brought to fruition, the proposals for improving Social Security.
I think that is going to depend very much on militant and alert citizens paying attention to what's going on and being prepared to defend Social Security.
Yes, and maybe some kind of movement among the old. They certainly got together to shoot down the idea of privatizing Social Security. We'll see if they can have a similar political motivation if they think Social Security can be improved.
Mm-hmm.
You've been listening to All About Aging, a public affairs program on WERU. Your host has been Peg Cruikshank. Tune in again on the third Wednesday of the month at 10 a.m. for more on aging. Thanks to the engineer, John Greenman, and stay tuned for On the Wing with Johnny Too Bad.
We've got a few minutes before the hour of 11 o'clock when we'll show up and put you into a world of music. Let's take a quick look at the weather outside while we're waiting. Today, partly sunny with a high near 70, south winds 3 to 8 miles an hour. Tonight, a chance of showers, mainly after 1 a.m., and mostly cloudy with a low around 53 tonight with the south winds 5 to 7. Becoming calm by midnight. Chance of precipitation 30%. Now we're going to get some rain on Thursday. Showers likely mainly between noon and 2 p.m. Then rain likely after 2 p.m. Cloudy with a high near 68. Southeast winds 3 to 5. Chance of precipitation 70% with new precipitation amounts around a tenth to a quarter of an inch. Friday night rain, patchy fogs after 10 p.m. And Friday during the day, rain likely before 11 a.m. Chance of showers after 11 a.m. Mostly cloudy and a high near 70.
Support for WERU comes from our generous listeners. Thank you.
New England town meetings are traditional opportunities for citizens to do democracy. But is local governance a lost art? Who is making local decisions and policy? Find out on the Democracy Forum. Ann Luther of the League of Women Voters of Maine and guests will discuss how well we govern locally. Friday, June 21st, from 10 to 11 a.m. on the Democracy Forum.